What up, guys? It's JP from the Double Double Podcast, and I'm here with my co-host, Ben.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome.
And today we're going to wrap up all Series 1 remaining games, series that have ended, and we're also going to move on to the second round series as well. Let's start off with the team I root for, the Cleveland Cavaliers, winning Game 7 over the Orlando Magic. I can't say I'm surprised. I thought the Cavs would win this. My initial prediction was 5 after that game one. My initial prediction was 7, but after seeing game one, I thought it might be over in 5 just because they looked so dominant defensively. This one got stretched out. Cleveland is just so Donovan Mitchell reliant, and that's kind of what I want to talk about. And I also want to talk about Jared Allen's injury. So first off, Donovan Mitchell is one of the best postseason players of me and your generation. He rises in basically every statistical category that matters. And what we're seeing here for specifically his tenure on the Cleveland Cavs is he drags these teams to victories, right? The offense is shit around him. And because he's so great, that's why they're winning. And I just love watching this guy. And like, he is such an amazing player.
He was incredible. In game 7, he was incredible. Was it game 6 that he had 50 in?
Yep.
Absolute backpack performance by Donovan Mitchell. And I think he outscored the rest of his team combined through game 6 and 7.
Yeah.
So just an unbelievable performance from him. Specifically in game 7, you know, you could talk about Donovan Mitchell being incredible, and that's absolutely the story. Two guys that I just want to give a quick shout out to as guys who have gotten so much grief from Cavs fans, but they would not have won this game without Isaac Okoro. He had some excellent defensive moments. He hit some clutch shots when they were starting to build momentum back. Caris LeVert had 15 points when they needed points because they started that first quarter down 18 quickly. And then just momentum started to build in the Cavs' favor. Donovan Mitchell through the whole way was unbelievable. But defensively, it was an excellent effort from the entire Cavs unit in that second half. And that's what won him game 7.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Bickerstaff was questioning whether to play LeVert at all at points in this series. Like, there were large extended stretches where he was just sitting on the bench because Bickerstaff didn't trust him in any regard. So for him to come out in a game 7, and then go 5 for 9, give us 15 points, 4 assists, 5 rebounds with good defensive effort. Like, that was so desperately needed. Okoro, you're right. Like, yeah, he was needed. His defense is going to be a really interesting topic next series, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But, you know, guys stepped up when they needed to. The guy I particularly thought did the most for this team that had struggled in the beginning of the series was Max Strus. I spoke to you, I think, on the pod, but also off the podcast on why you sign a guy like this, and for the amount you sign him for with $16 million, is just the chance he gets hot, right? He is modern-day Danny Green, where he's either in Antarctica, frozen cold, or he's in the Sahara Desert, like, absolutely blazing hot. And when he gets hot, he swings results of games. He hit 3 threes in that third quarter, quick 9 points. When Orlando's struggling to shoot, when you get that offensive burst from a role player, it just makes you really hard to stop. And that's why you go get a Max Strus in the offseason.
He had an excellent third quarter in game 7 and an excellent third quarter. I believe it was game 5. He hit 3 threes in the third quarter of game 5 as well. And you're absolutely right. That's why you bring a shooter like that. I absolutely gave him a little bit of shit to you off the pod. I'm not sure if I did it on the pod, just about the consistency of these games. But when you need it in a game 7 and he shows up, cannot have any complaints. Evan Mobley is a guy you have a little bit to talk about. Before we get to anything offensively, I just want to hammer home that defensively, this man's amazing. And yeah, that any conversation that happens about Evan Mobley has to just be about the things he does great defensively. We have to spend a lot less time harping on the offensive problems. We know they exist, but the defense he brings is unbelievable. 5 big blocks last night. He was a massive part of the Cavs defense.
And 16 rebounds.
Yes.
Not only is he like making possessions difficult, but he's ending them too by grabbing the defensive rebounds. this is what made me love him so much coming out of USC. It was, okay, I think he's one of the best defenders of this generation. I thought there was going to be some more offensive output, but what really drew me in was he just didn't make mistakes on defense. He was always in the right position. He was a great shot blocker, could slide his feet, all super versatile as a defender. We're seeing that mean so much to these Cleveland Cavaliers. And like, yes, the offense will always be a topic of question with him, but when he's that lone big out there, he's just awesome, right? Because then the spacing becomes less of a concern because other players on the roster can fill that gap. But Evan Mobley really is like such an impactful player. It's just, how does he fit best? And he fits best as a center. And with Allen hurt, we're kind of getting to see that, where his defensive impact and rebounding really, really matter.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was really, really good in this game.
Yeah, the defensive stuff is absolutely something you gotta harp on. We had a little bit of talk about his offense off pod, and like, there's definitely some issues there. Looking at his stats for the series, 12 points, 9 rebounds, 1.7 assists, doesn't strike you as an unbelievable performance. Three blocks a game is something you gotta keep in mind, though.
For sure. And I'd be lying if I said that I wasn't a little disappointed, right? I think 12 points is a little ridiculous from a guy that was the third overall pick and once, you know, in my mind, a generational type player. But he was a defensive anchor. And, you know, when you know Orlando's only strength is getting to the rim and you have a guy that can really make that strength kind of turn into a weakness, that's super important in closing out the series. And I think he did that. And we saw him in isolation against Paolo eat his lunch. Like, he just completely stopped Paolo from going on any extended runs once he became his primary defender. So yes, I am disappointed with his overall performance in the series in terms as an offensive player, but the Cleveland Cavs don't win this series without him as a defender.
You're absolutely right. Moving on to the Orlando side, I think it's a kind of easy story. It's a story we have been talking about since the draft last season. Orlando Magic need three-point shooting. I think we were talking about this months before last year's draft, about the importance of the Magic bringing in real three-point shooters. And that's really what killed them. Paolo Banchero is incredible. And I think we have to spend a lot of time talking about that. He averaged 27-9-4 for the series. On pretty good efficiency, 40% from three. This man's going to be, once he becomes a top 10 player, he's never going to leave that conversation, and he's going to be fighting for all NBA first teams very soon.
Yeah, I kind of view him as a franchise cornerstone first team all NBA guy to me. That's kind of how I'm viewing him. To lead a team to close to 50 wins in your second year as a 21-year-old is ridiculous. And he's such an polished offensive player already, and he's so uniquely dominant because of his side and skill combination where he has that silky dribble, but he's also 6'10 and 250. The only reason they lost this series is team building. That is it. Right. If you gave him a competent team around him built to his skill set, this team is going farther than where they are right now and probably give the Celtics a little bit of trouble as well. Okay, sorry, we had a little bit of technical difficulties there, but just quickly, I just want to compare them to the Bucks when they were being built. Giannis and Chris Middleton were a pairing, and they didn't have the right pieces around those two guys, and they kept flaming out in the postseason. But the second they got adequate spacing on that team, they became a championship contender. I see a similar future in the Magic.
Yeah, I think that's, honestly, you're dead on, and that's why we hammered that so hard when the offseason was happening, about how important it could have been if instead of drafting Anthony Black and Jet Howard, you went and got a legitimate player who's got some veteran experience who could help them in a playoff run. They didn't do it, and you go and you look at the three-point numbers for this team, Paolo at 40%, crazy, given the rest of the shooting numbers for the rest of the team. Franz Wagner, 27% from three. Jalen Suggs, excellent shooting year from him in the regular season, 29% from three. Wendell Carter Jr., 28%. So he needs help, and that is, you know, as big of an understatement as there can be. Franz Wagner needs to have the biggest prove-it year next year. The efficiency needs to be off the charts, because what we saw from him in this series, especially in Game 7, and the inefficiency we've seen from him just in general this season, needs to improve.
Yeah, he's starting to be treated like Ben Simmons. This is getting really hairy for Magic fans. I think, you know, that Vucevic trade, when you draft Franz and he comes out and has an awesome rookie year and then a pretty good second year as well, you're starting to think, holy shit, we have a 1-2 duo that could like really be dangerous. And then this year kind of makes you revert back and think, maybe Franz isn't the guy we thought he was. Because if the shooting's going to be mid-20s from three, you just don't have to respect him as a basketball player anymore. That's just how it works at that forward position. If you can't shoot a lick, no one gives a fuck. And, you know, there needs to be a big bounce back, because I've compared him to Chris Middleton as a caliber of player. Chris Middleton's like a fringe all-NBA guy and like a lock on all-star teams if everyone's healthy. And the Bucks are like winning 50, 60 games, right? Like, he's just a guy that you usher into an all-star game. Franz definitely has something to prove next year, especially if he wants that max rookie contract this season.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he deserves that. I wonder if the Magic will be forced to shell it out to him. We have had back and forth, me and you, about who Franz Wagner is, and I liken him more to like a Kyle Kuzma level of player. So, you know, that is certainly not a bad player, but it's a role player, and it's a guy who's not an all-star. So next year's a massive prove-it year for him. Jalen Suggs, honestly, for the fact that this was his first healthy year, his first good year, I'm giving him some pass. 29% from three. If that was closer to his regular season numbers, that alone might have been enough to win them this series.
I agree. And I've compared him to Derek White, is kind of who I see in him. This looked more like Marcus Smart. This series looked a lot more like Marcus Smart, where he's not afraid to shoot, and he shouldn't be, right? Because the Magic have prioritized him as the third best offensive player on their team this entire year. Mm-hmm. So it does kind of fall on his shoulders when Franz is slacking for him to take a bunch of shots. But he couldn't make anything. Franz couldn't make anything. They combined for 3 of 28. That is, I don't know if I've heard of a worse performance by a second and third option in an elimination game. But I'm less concerned about him. With the same reason you just said, one, it's his first year being fully healthy. Two, I'm not sure he was fully healthy in this postseason. He got really, really hurt in game 2, I believe, where he had to get carried off the court. He came back, he fought through it. He looked active on defense, but like, I don't know. You don't just get carried off the court for no reason. I'm sure he was dealing with some pain to his lower leg. So I'm going to give him a slight pass. I think this is something we have to kind of keep stock of in further postseason series in the future. But like for right now, the Magic have a very bright future, but it's come to an end this season.
I think it's fair to give him a little bit of a pass on that, because the defense in game 7 looked atrocious. And, you know, that's probably injury related. That's probably not effort related in a game 7 of the biggest game of his life.
Right. This is a guy that's going to make first team all defense. Like, his defense doesn't just go if he's fully healthy. He's locked in every night. The attitude's there, the effort's there. Something probably was up.
Right. Right. So let's move on to the last first round series we haven't covered, Clippers Mavs. Talk about a weird series, man. From start to finish, every game felt kind of strange. Luka Doncic seems to be dealing with some knee troubles, still managed to average 30 in the series. I'm not sure how to feel about this series as a whole. We have talked off the pod pessimistically about the Clippers, and I could certainly go off on that front, but like, what's your biggest takeaway from this series?
That Kyrie's playing the best ball of his life. I think that's where I want to start, because we will have a Clippers conversation in a moment, but I just want to give credit to where credit's due. Kyrie's playing the best ball of his life. 27 points per game on 51% from the floor and 45% from three. That's unstoppable shit. I mean, he's like one of the best transition players in the postseason right now. He's one of the best pull-up shooters from three in the playoffs right now. He is just a complete offensive player. And I've kind of gone on a limb a few times with this take that he's a good defender when he wants to be. He is. Like, I just don't care what people tell me. Like, he is. When he tries, he's athletic enough and slippery enough to, like, actually impact the game defensively. And I believe I've seen that effort in this series. So, you know, it just makes me excited to see a player that, quite honestly, like, I've hated in my past, because of how big of a distraction he was to prior teams, especially the Celtics. Like, he literally killed my fandom for the Celtics because of how obnoxious he was. It's kind of cool to see him just, like, play basketball and be happy and, like, just enjoy the company of his teammates. It's like, it sounds simple, but it's kind of nice to just see a guy without the distractions.
Yeah, man, because that's the only thing slowing him down from being as amazing as he is on the floor, is all of the nonsense distractions off the floor. And the health, honestly. The fact that he's been able to play through the series, the fact that he's had such a healthy streak to end the regular season, that's not Kyrie. That's not, you know, historically something he's been capable of. So it is a kind of perfect melding where the chemistry in Dallas seems to be pretty solid, and also he's healthy and he's just putting together unbelievable game after game. You laid out the averages: 51% from the field, 45% from three on 8 threes a game. Luka Doncic was clearly hurt through this series, and that's not something I really see getting any better, but Kyrie has done his best to just backpack some of that extra offensive load.
Yeah, and that's the next thing we need to talk about is Luka's injury. The only reason the Mavs won this series is because Kawhi was also hurt, right? And James Harden, pants pooper extraordinaire, he continues his legacy. That is why the Mavs won this series. With Luka Doncic only shooting 40% from the floor and 23% from three, they don't beat other teams in this postseason. They just don't. If Kawhi was healthy, they get ravaged. Unfortunately, Kawhi's never healthy, so we don't care about that. But it does make me worried for them moving into the next series. A lot of people are picking the Mavericks because Luka's the best player in the series and they have prior postseason experience. But if he's 40% from the floor and 23% from three, they're not beating the OKC Thunder. They're just not.
No, you're absolutely not. The Thunder have been the successful team they have through the season because their half-court offense and defense is really solid. That's been the story. So picking on Luka Doncic for 40 minutes a night is going to happen every single night. So they're going to have to try to find a way around that, and I think that's going to be very challenging. I don't know how the Mavs are the team that are favored to win this series. I think the Thunder got to be the team that come out. We'll talk more about that when we get into that series. Yeah. But, like, the Luka Doncic injury is everything. If he was fully healthy, we could have an entirely different conversation. But he is clearly sluggish. And those numbers, the percentages, are just awful.
Yeah. It's not looking good in terms of Luka's health. Obviously, it looks great for them winning a first-round series over the Clippers, who are their hypothetical, like, kryptonite, right? Mm-hmm. But let's talk about the Clippers a little bit before we move on to the next second round series. Me and you have both kind of come to the conclusion they're done. This was kind of the year, right, where Harden was clicking for 28 games. Kawhi was healthy for like 28 games straight. You know, Paul George was a fringe All-NBA player at the age of 34. This kind of felt like the year that they could have done it back in like January when they went on that like 25-3 streak. Seeing Kawhi enter a third straight playoff series unhealthy and not able to contribute to games, I think it's time that we all just kind of accept, one, he's not a championship mover anymore. Like, I'm going to update my NBA top 20 players list. He will not be in the top 10 anymore because those 10 spots are for guys that move championships in my eyes, and he just doesn't do that anymore, and that's something I have to come to grips with as a huge Kawhi fan. But what are your thoughts on just the Clippers, where they go from here, and just how this all played out for them in this postseason?
Where they go from here is the most interesting, and like for me, where I've been the most pessimistic about them, because I truly have no idea. This is the third year in a row that they're knocked out in the first round because health is just not on their side. And, you know, we love Kawhi Leonard on this podcast, and he is an unbelievable player. If you could get 6 healthy games from Kawhi Leonard, you are winning almost any series that you are in. That's just not the story, and it sucks that we got 68 healthy games from him in the regular season just for it all to mean nothing in the playoffs, man. So It sucks to just shit on them because there were some moments early in the season where they looked so fun and everything was gelling and you could really see how it could work out in a playoff setting. But I am done considering this team to be any type of contender. I think the fun that they bring in the regular season is valuable. Only one team wins the chip. So, you know, it's better to be a competitive, fun team than to be a bottom feeder. But this team is not a team that's going to win a championship with this core.
And I tend to agree at this point. Kawhi, I think his best years are behind him. You know, I've been trying to optimistically look at him for years now. But 2019 was the last time he was healthy for a playoff run. And by the finals, he was limping in games. So, like, what makes me think all of a sudden he's just going to be able to play four straight rounds of playoff basketball? Like, it just seems super unlikely. And that kills me to say because I really do think, like, give me that guy healthy over basically anyone in the league. But we just don't see that guy healthy. So it doesn't really matter. But yeah, I just think the Clippers are in a really weird spot. We talked kind of about their offseason where it's, you know, they already extended Kawhi to basically a max. Paul George is an unrestricted free agent. You kind of have to give him the max if you don't want to lose him for nothing. And then you traded for James Harden. Are you just going to let him walk out the door again? Or do you give him the max, which he's wanting? They're in a very odd spot.
They're in a terrible spot, man. Yeah, and to think about how they get out of it, I'm not entirely sure. Paul George, does he want to be maybe a third star on a team? The Philly thing just seems so likely. Especially after just the pants-pooping performance of Game 7. Paul George tried to shed that. You know, there was a moment there where we thought, okay, he's no longer the playoff pants-pooper. He's kind of fine now. Putting him as a third star over in Philly, over in another situation, seems like an ideal thing. I doubt he's leaving LA, though. If you offer, you know, $50-something million, he's going to stay. They're going to be a fun regular season team, and that'll be the extent of it.
Yeah, and that, I mean, there's not much room to negotiate with those results, right? I mean, that's kind of the place they've put themselves with the moves they've made and the people they've decided to pay. And, you know, you're going to bring fans to the arena. Games 1 through 82. And then, you know, once the postseason starts, you can kind of just expect a loss in the first round. And they are the worst place you can be in the NBA, which is dead in the middle. And it feels like they're stuck there.
They're in no man's land with the talent to be genuine contenders. It is certainly one of a kind in terms of situations going on in the NBA.
Alrighty, let's move on to the first series that has started in the second round. And this, we knew it was going to be a absolutely historic series. I want to start because I was slamming my table last year before everyone started falling in love with Anthony Edwards to the extent they have this year. And when Rudy Gobert was the worst trade in NBA history, I was saying that the Wolves would have taken the Nuggets to 7 if Jaden McDaniels didn't break his fucking hand right before they made the first round, okay? So to preface our conversation, I want to say I knew it all along. but this is going to be an awesome series, and we saw Game 1, and the Wolves went into Denver and stole Game 1. What were your thoughts when you saw that happen?
That was a surprise, man. I did not see that coming whatsoever. We can start with the hot takes. Anthony Edwards is the fifth best player in basketball. I think that is where the hot takes start. You know, the reason he's not on that list is because during the regular season, he takes games off. We'll see 14-point performances. We'll see lazy whatever defense through a first half. He might lock in the fourth quarter. He might not. But when the playoffs start, I can't give you five guys that I'd rather have than Anthony Edwards. You know, maybe I can't give you four. Maybe there's even less guys. But the shit that he can do, the efficiency that he can score the ball, the way that he can get baskets from anywhere on the floor, it's so unstoppable when he's locked in. It's such beautiful basketball. I'm loving what I'm seeing from the Timberwolves. And, like, wow, is it a rough time for the West, man. Because I thought Denver was going to have a really nice road, but Minnesota might come out of this series, man.
Yeah, it's not out of the realm of possibility.
No way. Right?
You know, we see Jokic put up a 32-8-9, and it honestly looks like a bad game.
Yeah, 7 turnovers, 44% from the field. That's not an excellent game.
That's a pretty bad Jokic game,
yeah.
Right? So, and I've talked about it a lot. It's kind of stemming back to last year when me and you were having the Karl-Anthony Towns trade, you know, discussions, where I think because the way they're built, they are uniquely a threat to Denver, right? When you have the 3-7 footers that you can just continuously rotate to keep positional size on the court, and then you also have Jaden McDaniels, who's 6'10", 6'11", there are just arms everywhere, right? Passing lanes stop working. Shots at the rim get an extra contest from behind and from the side every single time. They are constructed to beat the Nuggets.
Yes, yes.
The only reason the Nuggets were favored in this series is because, one, they were paid due respect for winning the championship last year, and they seemingly have a top 10 player of all time in his prime. But team construction-wise, the Timberwolves are literally crafted to beat this team.
Yeah, and there's a specific action that I kind of want to talk about and compare to the Nuggets-Lakers series, which is the Jokic-Gordon action. Against the Lakers, LeBron James was guarding Aaron Gordon all of the time. And so any pick and roll that had Jokic going downhill, the option for LeBron is step up to Jokic and he throws a lob to Gordon, or stay home and Jokic gets a free floater. When you have 3-7 footers on the floor, it takes away the ability for him to get that easy floater off or that easy lob off, because a lot of those angles are covered just by the insane length in Minnesota. So, you know, the reason for 7 turnovers, the reason for not much action for Aaron Gordon, that's been taken away. So the secret to the Nuggets winning this series is going to be Michael Porter Jr. and Jamal Murray being red hot from three. I can count on that from Michael Porter Jr. any day of the week. Jamal Murray has got to find his form quickly.
And I think it looks eerily similar to Devin Booker in the Phoenix series. The Timberwolves are ready to hound you for 94 feet.
Yes.
And we saw what it did to Booker, right? Booker figured it out by game 4, right? He dropped a 50 bomb, but those first 3 games, he was neutered, right? Like, he barely had effects on the game. Jamal Murray, I think, is a lesser player than Devin Booker, like, by quite a significant margin, in my opinion. Is he going to figure it out by game 4? I don't know. Like, Nickeil Alexander-Walker and Anthony Edwards just taking turns, and Jaden McDaniels all just taking their turn on Jamal Murray. Fresh legs every single time, different looks, different athleticism. Like, that's a tough spot to be in if you're Jamal Murray.
It is a very tough spot to be in. What it comes down to is going to be Jokic kind of changing some things up, which probably looks like being a little more tight with the ball and taking more shots. He already took 25 in game 1. That seems to be the story when Minnesota and Denver play each other, is Minnesota says, we will cut off every passing avenue we possibly can and turn every opportunity around 10 feet is going to be a Jokic shot attempt. We'll see if you can beat us with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it works really well, but I just want to highlight some guys on the Minnesota side. And specifically, Naz Reid coming out with a heater to put the Timberwolves ahead. He's such a fun player, man. And I feel like every time we talk about the Timberwolves, I want to just give shout outs to Naz Reid. He gets just some of the smoothest buckets, especially by a 7-footer.
We spoke about this last year, and we should have done it this year. We missed this opportunity, but creating the elite role players list.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, I had the Timberwolves with 3. Which was Mike Conley, Kyle Anderson, and Naz Reid. Now I think they have 4, with Nickeil Alexander-Walker becoming an absolute pest on defense. And Kyle Anderson, like, yeah, he's not as good as he was last year for them. So maybe they do have 3, but they just have guys upon guys upon guys upon guys. And when Karl-Anthony Towns is being an idiot, they can pull him out of the game and replace his offensive production immediately without a second thought because of Naz Reid. That just doesn't happen. You just can't find a 20-10 guy on every bench in the NBA, but the Timberwolves have one in Naz Reid.
Yeah, man. Some of the best center work that they have. It's pretty insane. Karl-Anthony Towns himself had a pretty excellent game. He's starting to kind of change the narrative about him as a yep. like do nothing, provide nothing, give no impact kind of playoff guy. He was awesome in game one, man. And the fouling, you know, it's always going to be an issue. I think that's just a thing, man. Carl Anthony Towns is not a gifted defender. He's going to be giving it through energy, and that means fouling sometimes.
And it sucks because in spurts, I'm like, fuck yeah, look at him go. And then he'll just ruin it with like a swipe down or a dumb foul. You know, but the effort's there. Like you said, it's kind of misguided effort at most points, those fouls. Timberwolves don't even care because they have Naz Reid on the bench. And you're right. Karl Anthony Towns has turned himself from one of the biggest pants poopers in the NBA to a hyper-efficient hired gun where he's just taking shots over and over and over again and making basically all of them.
Yeah. The passes, too. The swing passes that he does, too, are really nice, man, because he sees the floor really well for a dude at his size, and it's, like, very underrated. I certainly don't talk about it ever. But you see it in times like this. Three assists kind of undersells it. I love the way this team is constructed, but genuinely, if Anthony Edwards is scoring close to 40 points in a game, you're not winning. With all of the defense that Minnesota brings, if he's hitting those numbers, you know, it's a very tough path to victory.
Yeah. If he's playing this way, they win, right? If this is even semi what he's doing throughout the entire series, it doesn't have to be 43, but if it's like 34 a night, on great efficiency, this series belongs to Minnesota, which is crazy to say, but like we're starting to reach the point with Anthony Edwards now where he is just an all-time great prospect. It's kind of weird to think about, but he's 22. He's only a year older than Brandon Miller. And this is his fourth year in the NBA, and he's already solidified himself as a playoff great, an all-time playoff great. We haven't seen players be this good this young basically ever. The list is Luka and LeBron in terms of postseason playoffs. I don't know. It kind of makes you think like anything's possible for this kid at any point. Like, could he just run off a crazy historic playoff run and win a title this year? Like, I don't know.
Like, the way we construct legacies with this guy, with these guys, he has the potential to be in some insane conversations because of the fact that this success is happening so young. Especially, you know, because if they're able to beat Denver, they're destroying OKC. I don't think that's even a series.
No, I agree. Me and you both agreed on this the entire year. Minnesota would dog walk OKC in a series because of the size difference. Yeah. Sorry to cut you off there, but
no, you're 100% right. It would be uncompetitive. So they get to the finals, and do I trust Anthony Edwards over Jason Tatum in big moments? Yeah. So if they win a finals and he at 22 already has a finals MVP, he'll go into next season with potential like MVP discussions. He's got a chance to be in some insane conversations. Most guys, I think everybody knows this, do not win championships until they're, 27?
Yeah.
So for him to do it with this much of a head start and the fact that the core is already put together for the following years, like it's Denver and Minnesota in the West battling head to head to see who wins these chips moving forward.
Exactly. And it's just, this is also just a credit to Tim Connelly too. Why are we talking about like GMs and shit, but like he built Denver and now he built Minnesota.
Yes.
And you know, he made the move because he believed in Anthony Edwards, right? You see this young and upcoming budding superstar, and you just give him the best team humanly possible and say, let's see where he can take us. And, you know, the Cavs tried it, but they were betting on a little bit of a different guy in Evan Mobley, right? He's not even close to Anthony Edwards. Ant fulfilled his potential. So Tim Connelly made a bet, it worked out, and now we're seeing what could be a historic playoff run from a guy that's 22. The only thing that can come to my mind as like a similar type of scenario is Dwayne Wade winning a finals MVP at 23,
mm-hmm.
and then Magic Johnson winning a finals MVP at like 19 or 20. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like that. Both of those guys are, you know, historic greats, like top 40 for Dwayne Wade and Magic's top 10. It's just crazy shit, man. It's really insane.
Yeah, man. And honestly, it's kind of an either direction thing where the only way Denver comes out of the series with a win is through historic Jokic performances.
Yeah.
So either one of these guys is just flinging themselves up the top, you know, 100 all-time player list.
Yeah.
I want to see the Nuggets come out on top, obviously, because I'm a Denver Nuggets fan. But that's what it comes down to for me, is Jokic is going to have a monster night. We're going to see something close to a 50 piece from him, I think, in this series.
And I think that's what I should talk about next is, or we should talk about next. I still have Denver winning the series.
Yeah.
Right. So like, yes, this has been super fun for Minnesota. Like I said, they are perfectly crafted to beat this Denver team. I'm going to put my money on the guy who's top 10 all time in his absolute peak prime. That's what I feel comfortable with. It feels weird doubting Anthony Edwards in any regard, and I'm sorry, but I'm going to do that because Jokic has won too many games where I thought it wasn't a possibility, and I doubted Jokic heading into the postseason last year, and he won with he ended up with a ring around his finger and a trophy in his hand. So it just kind of feels silly for me to try to do that again. But man, this series is going to be a bloodbath. It's definitely going 7, 100%.
I think you're 100% right. The Timberwolves will not let Jokic win this series through passing. That's been their key pretty much every time. Somebody else is going to pass for you, or you're just going to score. So yeah. Jamal Murray, you know, we put a lot of pressure on his shoulders, and it's kind of self-imposed. He's the one who's putting up all these 50-point games. He's the one who's kind of made us view him as this immediate huge riser in playoff moments. So you know, regular season wise, what is he, a top 30 player?
Probably
somewhere in that range, but we expect, you know, top 20 performance, maybe a little bit higher from him come playoff time. I don't know how he does it, man, because it's so consistent from Minnesota. The energy and the effort on defense, it's insanity.
For me, this is a Denver gets their three-point looks in, kind of similar to what you said earlier. But also, they need to make a defensive shift where KCP can no longer be on an island with Anthony Edwards ever again.
Yeah.
Right? It was just barbecue chicken. And his center of gravity, he's 6'4", but he's 225 of pure muscle. KCP's a slender guy. He's going to get eaten alive all series long if they try that strategy again. I think Aaron Gordon needs to be the primary defender on Anthony Edwards. At least he can challenge Ant vertically and, you know, weight-wise. It's just, is he fast enough side to side to stay with probably the best first step in the entire NBA? That's going to be the issue. But you have to try something new if you're Denver.
Yeah, and is that the play to kind of upsize, maybe swap out KCP for a Peyton Watson? At least you get a larger body out there. You sacrifice some offense in the doing, but I just don't know what the strategy is.
I kind of have a weird take. I would put KCP on Rudy Gobert and just like absolutely make him be something he doesn't want to be, which is an offensive focal point where it's like, I have the mismatch, guys. I have the mismatch. And then, okay, Rudy, go cook. Like, that would be my strategy. I don't know how that would affect the rebounding and stuff, which obviously would probably end up being an issue, but all I know is Ant can't get looks the way he was getting looks the other night. So you got to, that's priority number one if you're Mike Malone.
You're 100% right. I think the Nuggets take game two, but I think this is a 7-game series.
Who wins it?
Denver.
Okay, we both have Denver in 7.
Yeah.
Man, Minnesota's going to be a problem in the future, though. Good Lord.
Yes. Oh, 100% agree. They are here right now, man.
Really quick, sorry, before we move on from Minnesota-Denver, if Minnesota does win it, you're a Celtics fan. Is that a team that scares you?
No, not the way the Nuggets do.
That's so interesting, because I've heard that same sentiment from every Celtics fan I know. And that's an interesting kind of thought process from you guys.
Yeah, I don't know. The three-point shooting is something where the size that Minnesota has really makes it difficult to score inside. But if the Celtics are going to jack 53s in a game, you know, whatever, the Rudy Gobert's in the paint.
Fair.
But it'll definitely be a competitive series. They play entertaining basketball against each other.
For sure. Let's move on to the next series. Our teams are facing each other in the postseason. Boston and Cleveland are facing off. That was Cleveland's reward for beating the fifth seed Magic. You get to face the fourth best team of all time in terms of net rating.
Fully healthy. Full rest.
Full of rest, yeah, right? No, they're not going to have no Kristaps this series. Yeah. What I think is interesting is the Cavs may not have Jared Allen for game one or two.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a benefit? Is that a detriment? I don't know. I think this series is pretty quick. I'm going to give Cavs the respect of winning one game because Donovan Mitchell is the best playoff player in the series. Honestly, bro, Celtics fans, you can have Jason Tatum. That's fine. Donovan Mitchell has proven time and time again that in these moments, he is better than basically anyone you put across from him. I'm going to respect him and say he puts up a 40-piece and steals a game for Cleveland, but I have Boston in five.
Yeah, you can't give any disrespect to Donovan Mitchell. It's really just the lack of offense that the rest of the entire team can come up with.
Right.
Darius Garland seems to play good basketball against the Celtics. Do we have faith in good Darius Garland basketball? He hasn't been excellent through the playoffs so far.
Yeah. I don't.
Yeah.
I don't.
I think it's a quick series too, man. I think it's a 5-game series. The Celtics can't play with their lunch, really. This has to be a series that they take very, very seriously because the Cavs play them close in the regular season, and the energy is always there in a Cavs-Celtics game. So I hope it's a quick series. I really think it can be any type of way. You know, there's a lot of different ways that the Celtics can come out with a win in this series. There's no, like, specific angle I'm looking for, but I really hope it's a quick.
Something I want to shoot towards you, is there any way that the Cavs can make this more competitive than we're making it? I'm going to run down the 3-point shooting for the Cavaliers in the first round. Donovan Mitchell shot 25% from three. Evan Mobley, 27. Max Strus, 31. Caris LeVert, 23. Isaac Okoro, 23. I'm not saying they're a lights-out sniper team. That's not what I'm saying at all. But those are the worst percentages I've ever fucking seen in my life. If they regress closer to the mean of their normal regular season averages, does this become a 6-game series, or do you just not even see that happening for them?
So we do have to give Orlando credit when it comes to those shooting numbers.
Yeah.
A lot of people are just going to disregard that series entirely, which I hate, and I think that sucks. Orlando's a fun-ass team. It was a fun series. Their defense is legit, and that's why those numbers are what they are. I think if the Cavs shoot 40% from three as a team, they lose in 5 games.
Okay.
I don't see it happening, first of all. I don't see them all coming together. Caris LeVert plays some great games against Boston from time to time. There's a bunch of guys that all individually have had some pretty career nights against the Celtics. So, you know, maybe if two of them string together at the same time, you can get an extra game out. But that really comes down to just poor offense from the Celtics side, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think even if the Cavs shooting gets better, Boston's the far more talented team. We saw a guy like Max Strus heat up and like basically destroy the Celtics last year alongside Caleb Martin. That's kind of the only thing that gives them a shot, is if Max Strus starts playing like he did last year against this same team, like that would make the series more competitive. But from personal experience and as an Evan Mobley defender, the team he plays the worst against in the entire league is the Celtics. You can count on single digits from him this entire series. Tatum's too big and too strong for him to take advantage of, but it also allows Boston to guard him with a smaller player. But their smaller player is 6'10". So Mobley basically becomes a zero on offense in this series. If I'm Cleveland, if I'm trying to gain respect from the league and other GMs, I think my strategy would just slam the offensive boards. With Kristaps out, that man's 7'3". He makes it really difficult to grab boards. You have 2 7-footers. If you decide to go back to that 2 7-footer lineup, I think you need to have Strus, Mitchell, and Garland out on the perimeter and have Mobley and Allen crash every single miss and don't even play transition defense. Disregard its existence. Approach it like the Knicks approached the Cavs series last year, where they're just hounding the boards and getting open kickout threes. That's kind of the only chance I see them making this thing go six. The Celtics, I respect them so much as a basketball team. I really don't think this is going to be competitive.
I'm right there with you. Donovan Mitchell is a monster. That's what it comes down to. And he is going to single-handedly make some games more competitive than they probably ought to be.
Yeah. Yes.
How do you feel about just Donovan Mitchell and his role in Cleveland? We've talked about it time and time again on pod, off pod. He had a thing in a post-conference after game 7 about, like, you know, I didn't come here to win one first round series in seven games. How do you feel about his tenure here and whether or not it's coming to an end pretty soon?
It probably is coming to an end. And I think Jared Allen's tenure needs to come to an end as well. Like I said a few podcasts ago, I've flip-flopped 100 times on this subject. I've basically come to the realization that he's an awesome player. I'll forever be a fan after these few years he spent in Cleveland. Like, I will defend him to anyone who challenges him. But for Mobley's development and for Garland's development, he kind of needs to leave. And, you know, this team doesn't have a championship ceiling as long as Giannis and Tatum, well, Giannis and the Celtics are in this conference. So he probably has a better shot doing that somewhere else, unless, you know, the Pelicans want a Jared Allen, Brandon Ingram swap, right? Yeah, if that happens, perfect. But I don't really see that as a likelihood.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, I don't know. He probably demands a trade in the summer, which is kind of frustrating, but honestly, I totally get it.
Yeah, yeah, it is very frustrating. I would rather see the entire team imploded and everybody but one of the bigs, most likely Mobley, kept. And if it was just Donovan Mitchell and Mobley and we figure out the rest, I'd rather see it go from there. The Cavs are just so fun when he plays, man. And in these games, game six specifically, it sucked that it ended in a loss. But, like, the 50-point game from him, the carry job that he can do, if you just brought a little more offense to the team, if Darius Garland could just hit that all-star self of his that we saw, what could this team be, man?
It drives me crazy.
Yeah.
It drives me crazy. The Cavs really do feel like untapped potential to me. And you called it from day one, the redundancy will be an issue. It really kind of has lowered everyone's ceiling on the team, right? Like, I think Donovan Mitchell on another team could be a guy that maybe makes an Eastern Conference Finals or a Western Conference Finals. But on this team, he's not going to make an Eastern Conference Finals.
I think we'll be hearing him a lot more in top 10 talks.
Yeah, so it's been pretty frustrating. Back to the Celtics side of things, just because you're a Celtics fan, I kind of want to know from your angle why they win this series so convincingly. Is there a player or a strategy or just like a mismatch that you see specifically that believes you, like makes you believe they'll win dominantly?
I really think it's a team performance. I don't know how to feel about it. Obviously, the Jared Allen injury is interesting because it almost makes the Cavs a little bit better to not have to play with two bigs. But I just think the collection of three-point shooting that the Celtics have is going to bring them victories pretty comfortably. Drew Holiday is a big question mark, but I'm not as big of a doomer with him as a lot of other people are. Obviously, he should be probably fourth in the offensive rotation in terms of like shots attempted. But I'm comfortable with his corner threes. I'm comfortable with his low-volume offense. I think just all around the three-point shooting takes the Celtics home.
I tend to agree with you. What's so funny about Boston is, like, Tatum, Porzingis, and Holiday all had a stinker first series, and they fucking destroyed the Heat.
Yeah, it wasn't close. Yeah.
It wasn't close, like, a single time. And that game, too, the Heat stole from them, just felt like more of an aberration because of how many threes they made. Like, literally a historic shooting performance. Rather than like, ooh, this is competitive. So, yeah, I don't know. It just feels like no matter how the Celtics players perform, they win.
Yeah.
Which is like such a weird
Derek thing, White but shot 48% from three through the series. Yeah. Sam Hauser shot 48% through the series. Right. Derek White just had some incredible games. But it was really just like anybody can get it. Oh, Derek White's hot in the first quarter. Let's feed him. Oh, he's got 38 points. Jason Tatum doesn't have to do much. He's got 20, whatever. Like, who cares?
Yeah.
It's really a story of whoever is hot, whoever the Cavs are sagging off a little bit is going to burn them with some threes.
Pretty much. So, yeah, that'll be a quick one. I'm taking Boston in five. I think you are taking Boston in five as well.
I am, yeah.
Let's move on to Indiana, New York. This is kind of a weird one. I want to get your take on this first because we both hate both of these teams. You hate the Pacers and I hate the Knicks. I'd love to kind of hear like what you expect from this series.
I think this is going to be a quick series. I think this is Knicks in five. I think we'll see one miraculous, excellent shooting game team-wide from the Pacers. But the Knicks are a team that want it more. They try harder. And I think that's what it comes down to. When you have just the kind of lackluster garbage defense that Indiana brings night to night, that shit's not going to fly against New York. Jalen Brunson had to put the backpack on and take 30 shots a game against Philly. When you leave so many wide open shooters, he's not going to have to do that in this series. He's going to be able to let Dante DiVincenzo take a lot more points, let OG take a lot more points. And I just see no hope for Indiana's defense to slow them down.
I just want to let everyone know, we did not talk about this before, but I also have Knicks in five. Me and you have gone chalk with all of our picks. We've gone the same. Yeah. But as Indiana as a team, I feel like they're trash, right?
Yes.
I have a little bit more respect for them than you do, but I think the only reason they move past the first round is because Giannis is not healthy, right? If Giannis is healthy, I think the Bucks are a title contender. If Giannis and Dame aren't healthy and Bobby Portis wants to get ejected 10 minutes into a game, yeah, the Pacers are going to win. And like, that shouldn't shock anyone, really. The Knicks, however, they are so determined to rip out your heart and eat it in front of your crowd. This is gonna die quick. Like this, I totally agree. I have Knicks in five. I think the offensive boards are gonna be ridiculous because Indiana is not a team with physicality on it.
Yeah.
This is gonna be a bludgeoning.
I think this could be demoralizing, especially when you go to Indiana. I think the Knicks could really tear the heart out of that crowd. I don't know what the story is for Indiana, man. I have gone much harder with you off pod about Tyrese Haliburton than I've gone on pod. But really, I think it's fine. I think it's totally comfortable to say he is a live ball wizard with a good three-point shot. And that's where I'm going with it. I don't think he's a top 15 player. I don't think the All-NBA stuff is real. He had an excellent first 2 months of the season. Injury or not, the offense is not there.
I agree. The offense is not there. He's shooting 27% on wide open threes right now in the postseason. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, honestly, seeing that stat almost makes me want to think, like, just throw Brunson on him. You barely have to guard the guy,
yeah.
Right? Like, who cares if Brunson's playing defense on him? Because he's not going to take advantage of it. You know, I think OG probably takes the Siakam assignment, and you probably have Hartenstein follow Miles Turner around. Yeah, that'll probably open up some lanes for the Pacers to get to the rim, but who's getting to the rim? That's the question.
Obi Toppin dunks. Let's see all the Obi Toppin dunks. Yippee.
Yep, it's Obi Toppin and TJ McConnell.
Yeah.
That's who's getting to the rim for you. And like, if you're the Knicks, are you taking Jalen Brunson outscoring Obi Toppin and TJ McConnell? Like, yes, every day of the week. So I'm just kind of confused how anyone choosing the Pacers could choose the Pacers. Like, I don't know what the odds for this series are, but the Knicks should be so crazy favored in this. I really don't see a single avenue that the Pacers can make this competitive.
That's exactly where I'm at, man. Pascal Siakam is a beast, and he's an excellent playoff player. But being matched up 1v1 against OG, there's not many defenders who could do it better. So, you know, can Pascal Siakam reach those numbers he was hitting against Milwaukee? I don't think so. I don't think so at all. So it comes down to Tyrese Haliburton. Can we get some more points? Please, can we get some more points, man? He just refuses to shoot. I'm so sick of seeing Aaron Nesmith and Andrew Nembhard shot attempts, man. I understand that's the team, but, like, we know who the best player on the team is because we watched before. But I don't think watching through the playoffs, what you're seeing is that Pascal is the best player.
I don't think it's arguable.
No.
Yeah, like if you're watching that Bucks-Pacers series, not once did Tyrese Haliburton stand out to you as the best player, except maybe when he hit the game winner against the Bucks in overtime, right?
Right.
So I don't know. I think this is quick. I don't think this is particularly going to be fun to watch either.
No.
Like, I don't think these games are going to end up 101 to 103. I think this is going to be like 104 to 87. Like, shit like that. So
real quick, just these offenses, these run kind of offenses,
yeah,
and the way that they collapse in the playoffs. It seems like this is a story we have seen over and over again. We saw it with the Kings, this thing where, like, you rely on all of your buckets to be fast-paced and in transition, and then the playoffs cuts out all of those buckets. I don't know where the Pacers go, because that's such a huge chunk of what makes their offense so successful in the regular season.
I disagree a little bit there. I think Tyrese Haliburton, if healthy, this offense would be humming. So that's kind of where I disagree. And I also think, as a guy who bet against the Kings last year, and I thought the Warriors were going to win that first round series, if De'Aaron Fox didn't hurt his finger, they win that series, right? So I kind of disagree. I think these offenses can kind of dominate if you're facing an older team or a team with a lumbering center. I think you can destroy teams like that. So I kind of disagree with you there, but in this series, it doesn't kind of matter because the Knicks guys have a ton of effort everywhere and they don't care if you're running because they'll run too.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, I don't know if there's much that we can take away from this series because I just don't feel like it's that competitive. The Pacers are matched up with kind of a nightmare team for them.
Yeah, and I want to say something two ways. What they both teams can take away from this is the Pacers, it's all gravy for them, right? They won a postseason series. This was their first time back to the playoffs post-Sabonis trade, so they're all smiling and happy out there in Indiana. That's fine. And they believe they have a first-team All-NBA caliber point guard in Haliburton on their team.
First team?
First team. That's what they believe out there. I'll go second team. I think he's – I know we differ pretty hard on him, but like – I think he's a great player. He'll be healthy next season. That's great. But this team does have some issues that they need to address in the offseason. They fell short of trading for OG Anunoby. I think Jairus Walker would be a needed addition next year to give this team some semblance of defense. And then from New York's end, it's time to go big game hunting, right? Julius Randle's ego and attitude and just overall basketball IQ does not fit on this team at all. He is what gives them their ceiling as a potential like Eastern Conference winner against the Celtics if he just perchance decided to have a great offensive series. The issue is he's a horrible postseason player and dominates the basketball. If you're the Knicks, you need to go after Paul George or Devin Booker or something, because we're starting to see the core is good enough to get you to an Eastern Conference Finals. If you just maximize your offensive output with a new star replacing Randle, you are a title contender with Brunson as your 1A guy. So both of these teams can take something out of that a little bit.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. The OG sweepstakes is something I think about. The fact that the Knicks ended up with the ones that got him and the price that they ended up getting him for. How many teams in the league right now are kicking themselves for not even attempting? It's so interesting. The Knicks, what a run for them if they end up in the conference finals. I think the Sixers win has to be talked about with some respect. Joel Embiid, injury or not, he put up some excellent games, especially in that elimination game. So that was a hard-fought win. That's a win they deserve a lot of credit for. This one, I'm not going to give them much flowers for.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting. In a weird way, we can project out a little bit here because we think so similarly about this series. But a Knicks-Celtics Eastern Conference Finals, it's weird because I think the Celtics are soft, personally. That's kind of the mentality I think the whole team carries. But the Knicks are way less talented. And I think it was the same thing against Philly, and I think it's the same thing against Indiana. Obviously, I'm going to choose Boston to win that series, but I'm curious how competitive it is. Like, I think that might be a surprising series to some if it goes six or maybe even seven.
I think I'd fight you on the Knicks being less talented than the Pacers. I think they have. But it is a definitely good question, because the demoralizing plays that the Knicks bring, the Celtics feel like they could fall victim to those pretty easily. You go up 15 points, you feel like everything's gravy, and then Josh Hart flies in with three offensive rebounds for three kickout threes. Shit's a little bit different. We start collapsing. I could see that in the tea leaves. So
yeah,
I don't know, man. I think if Kristaps comes back, it's a different story. Calf strains are so interesting. Giannis was kind of an automatic out for the series after he got his, so who knows how long Kristaps will be out for, but you're right, the talent isn't close.
Yeah, it's not close, and just like the way New York plays, and I know this isn't a Tatum, it's more of a Brunson comment I'm going to make than a Tatum comment, but like, I think Brunson has proved himself to be better than most of everyone's favorite players, right? Like what he just did against Philadelphia, I'm not even sure another player in the league could sustain what he had to do, taking 29 shots a game it almost makes you not care about the efficiency at all because there was no second option. If I asked a random New Yorker who's the second best offensive player on the Knicks, I'd get four different answers, right? So, like, him having to take 29 shots a game and then leading them over the Philadelphia with, like, clutch shot after clutch shot after clutch shot, like, he is the best player in that Boston series, in my opinion. But it just won't matter because Boston's so well-rounded. But, like, that series is going to be more competitive than I think a lot of people think is basically my projection out.
I think it's possible. I don't think it will be. I think, you know, maybe it'll be four. The victories for the Celtics will be close margins, but I think it's a series that goes five or six. Six, probably. But I don't think it's something that the Celtics are sweating about.
No.
It's really like, you know, Minnesota or Denver. Those two teams battling it out right now are tougher than any team that the Celtics could face on their way to the finals.
The Lakers are tougher than any team the Celtics could face on their way to the finals. Like, this is not to diminish anything the Celtics have done this year, because we don't care about any of their wins until the finals anyway, right? But, like, in terms of getting to the finals, I don't know if I've seen an easier path in my life. None of this matters, right? None of this matters anyway, so we don't care how easy it is to get there. Yeah. But, like, this is, like, I texted you before the playoffs started. I think they might lose three games on their way to the finals.
Yeah.
One in each series. Like, it's fucking crazy what the Celtics have lined up for them to get to the big game or the big series.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, how many years have we done the this is the easiest path Team A has ever had thing? But, like, it is a very, very easy path for the Celtics this year. 100%. Yeah. Going through a battered Knicks team as their hardest competition. Not having to face Giannis and the Bucks, not having to face Embiid and the Sixers.
Yeah.
I couldn't have predicted it would go this easy. I really thought the Sixers were going to be the team that drags themselves to the conference finals.
Yeah.
Clearly, it's not going to happen, man.
Before we wrap up here, because we've covered all the series too, second round series, excuse me, we haven't mentioned the end of Sixers-Knicks. And just how that played out. And I want to have a bit of an Embiid conversation with you, because I think he is one of the most polarizing players in the league. And I kind of want to just do a little bit of a conversation about him, because the reason I was rooting for Philly so hard is twofold, right? I think the first was I think they could have given Boston a harder series than New York, right? I want some competition in the Eastern Conference. I don't want it to just be they lose three games and dominate every team by 20 points. That, to me, that's boring basketball. Number two, I think Joel Embiid's legacy is becoming one of the weirdest conversations in the NBA. I guess, like, where do you stand with Embiid, the Sixers, like, his career? After seeing another first-round loss, like, where do you kind of fall on that issue?
I think this is Embiid's first ever series where he's had more assists in a series than turnovers.
Yeah.
So, to me, we haven't been having a weird conversation about Embiid. We've been having a very, like, we all understand he's a pants pooper. For years and years now, whether it be injuries or what have you, you know, he's 7 feet tall, 300 whatever pounds. His body's struggling. But year after year, in the biggest moments, he doesn't shoot in the fourth quarter. This is a series where shit's different, man. I think, you know, that one miraculous Tyrese Maxey game where Embiid just went garbage, that was really a terrible performance. But besides that, we saw exactly what we wanted to see. MVP Joel Embiid stepping up and being incredible on both sides.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, I think Joel, after the series, still gets the pants pooper label. You know, he is the only MVP in the history of the league to not make the Eastern Conference Finals.
I think we give him a pass for this one. I don't know.
I'm glad you say that, because we texted off air and I went play for play on Joel Embiid's fourth quarter in game five. And it was one of the worst I had ever seen. He had some great, unbelievable defensive plays. So when I initially texted you, I said, that was a bad game, but it wasn't horrible. And you came back at me being like, what are you saying? And you are so right. I watched it again and I was like, if any other player did this, I would be so upset, right?
Giannis and Jokic would never. If we're having a top three conversation, yeah. that's what I came away with.
Exactly. And I gave him an excuse because he made some great defensive plays. But I thought to myself, I don't fucking care about that anymore. Like, I think Joel Embiid had an unbelievable series. I do. In totality, I think it was an unbelievable series. He finished with 33 points, 10 rebounds, and 6 assists. If any other player does that, they get rose petals thrown at their feet and praise from every corner of the world, even if they lost. But with him, because of his history, it's, Joel Embiid, pants pooper, he's never going to make an Eastern Conference Finals. Like, this dude's a bum. I'm just kind of at a loss with Embiid. I don't really know what to do.
Part of it with Embiid and part of it with this series is the 33 point whatever points a game looks pretty incredible. But the 50-point game's a big outlier there. So it wasn't like he was putting up around 30 points every game. It was he had one unbelievable showstopper of a game, and then he was putting up about 27 again. So it's not what we
expect. That matters.
Yeah, it's not what we expect from Embiid night after night. And, like, you know, that last elimination game, I'm not putting any blame on him because he was excellent. But games 5 and game 4, absolutely we could have seen better from him. But no, he deserves none of the blame for the fact that they lost this. Yes, he had one garbage game, but he averaged 33, 11, and 6. And Tobias Harris put up 0 in that elimination game. You can point to everybody on the team and find something to call out about them, I think, before you get to him.
I agree. And it kind of just makes me question, like, what happens from here, right? He has Tyrese Maxey, who has established himself as what I think I said on the pod, maybe not, maybe to you over text, as like maybe a fringe all NBA guy throughout his career as a second option. Like, he looks unstoppable as a second option. And Kelly Oubre, and then what else, right? Like, is this team going to have a better chance to do something against Boston next year or Milwaukee if they figure it out? Like, how does Philly actually get Joel to an Eastern Conference Finals or even a Finals? Like, do you have any ideas on how they do that?
I think it's okay to be pessimistic. You know, DeAnthony Melton was a guy that should have brought some good production. Injury kind of screwed him over. Buddy Hield, they get rid of some assets who were positive contributors to the team, and they bring in a dude who, you know, was very scared in game 1. Obviously, big lights too bright for him. It was his first playoff game. But, like, to shell him, to stick him to the bench, and to need that three-point shooting, I don't think he's coming back to Philly after that. So where is the talent coming from? Do they just beg and plead Paul George? That's what it comes down to for me.
And that's probably a fair, like, option for them, right? Just hope Paul George saves them as a third option. The thing that I keep seeing on Twitter that is driving me crazy is Joel Embiid, for his entire playoff career, is plus 48 when he's on the court and minus 47 when he's off the court. The team, the Sixers. That just feels like the most staggering difference, like, I've heard in the league. And it just makes me upset for how his career has kind of played out, where it's like, is this one of those guys where we look back and go, oh, he could have been top 30 all time, but actually he'll probably stay in the 60s. Like, that just feels like so weird to me, because he had Ben Simmons on his team, all-time fuckery. Tobias Harris on his team, all-time fuckery, right? Even when he had Jimmy Butler, Kawhi was on his absolute ape shit and hit a corner three to send them packing. Like, it just feels like every single stop, he's either at a broken orbital bone, the flu, a torn MCL, Bell's palsy, a shitty teammate. Like, every single fucking year, there's something with this guy. And it kind of just makes me sad about how his career has played out.
Yeah, yeah. I don't take much into the plus-minus stats, only because I feel like that's pretty common for any top five player. If you looked at Jokic's or Giannis's plus-minus stats, their teams are garbage when they're not on the floor. But
to that extent,
like, to Jokic, it might be worse.
But with Jokic, you always cared about that. We always had the backup center conversations. They need to figure it out. And that was the number we always looked at. I'm doing the same thing with Embiid. Like, why the fuck is it such a stark drop-off?
Right, right. It's a sign of bad team building. Just horrible, horrible team building.
That's what I'm saying.
100% I'm with you on that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, the fact that it hasn't led to more success with that kind of a rate. I definitely get you on that. But it's like, you look back historically, and you're right, man. It's been only bad decisions and bad luck. You know, the Ben Simmons, Markelle Fultz drafts seemed like the right decisions in hindsight.
Oof.
I will defend those decisions in hindsight, because they definitely were. Al Horford, giving him $100 million, I think that was a mistake. The Tobias Harris money was a mistake. There's so many mistakes that have been made. The James Harden shit, the fact that that didn't implode the team, the fact that they were able to still be competitive is a miracle. By picking up Nick Batum and Robert Covington, and they were still able to recuperate. That was miraculous. So they have been just shooting themselves in the foot over and over and over again, and they're surprised that nothing good's coming.
And I know me and you agree on this usually, is like peaks usually last 4 years, right? Yeah. Like, at your absolute peak powers, it's usually 4 to 5 years where you are unstoppable as a player and no one has any answers for you. And Joel this season seemed like it was the tippy top. So this is, you know, how many peak years does he have left? One, two?
Maybe.
Maybe.
It's all health-based, man, because what we saw from him this season is the best Joel Embiid we've ever seen, and if he had played 65 games, a unanimous MVP.
Unanimous. Yeah. Unquestioned best season in the league.
So we're seeing, like, a dude that could be a top whatever player of all time, and we're selling that, like, we're saying, yeah, he's got 2 years left before it's all over.
And just, like, what are the odds that Philly actually figures it out, right? And, you know,
what does it take?
Does it take getting a Paul George to sign and then, you know, hitting gold with a vet min guy who actually contributes to winning? Like, is it a good group of role players that you sign in free agency that all work out at the same time?
Right. Is that crop even available this summer?
Right. It just feels so unlikely that Embiid's career amounts to any winning ever. And it, I don't know. That's kind of just the conversation I wanted to have, where it's like, we're seeing an all-time talent go to waste because one of his injuries, that's the one. That's number one. But two, it's also just like the worst luck I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, I mean, it is Dame Lillard in Portland, man. You got a guy who is a top 10 player, and your team just refuses to get better around you. And they just keep saying, yeah, man, Tobias Harris, he'll figure it out next series. He'll figure it out next time.
Doesn't it feel a little different with Embiid? Like, at Dame's best, what was the highest he was ever ranked as a player in your mind? Like, at his absolute peak?
Oh, I don't know. Eighth, ninth?
Right, like Embiid was second.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, it's definitely a bigger crime. You're failing a more talented player. But yeah, that's the situation that it reminds me of.
It's a good comparison. Just different caliber of players, but like very similar situations where it's just like, oh yeah, Dame, don't worry. We'll get you Yusuf Nurkic and Evan Turner. Yes.
Our sixth man will be better than our sixth man was last year, but we're not going to really fix the starting unit.
Oh, you're 6 foot tall and can't play defense? Your second best player is also going to be 6 foot tall and can't play defense. Right. Like, just shitty fucking team building that robs these all-time greats of, like, proving their all-time greats. Right. Like, it's really weird shit with Embiid, man, and it just kind of makes me sick to my stomach a little bit that they can't figure it out.
It'd be really cool if they could go the Minnesota route, and they could go just size on size on size, and have Joel Embiid be a bit insulated with some bigger guys around him. That would be cool. There's not many guys who can even fill that role.
Not alongside him, right? If you sign Nick Claxton and put him at the four, that dude can't shoot for shit. Right. And then Embiid's forced to be outside.
Right.
You know, Embiid, yeah, he can stretch, but you want that dude 2 feet away from the basket where he's just dominating everyone.
But I think we're at this point where doing the four out thing puts way too much defensive pressure on Joel Embiid, and that kind of wears him down.
OG was the guy.
Yes.
That's the crazy part, is like OG's the guy who just sent them packing. Yes. But like, if you put OG Anunoby on that team, a first team all defense caliber player, defensive player of the year caliber wing, which is like impossible to find, you put that next to Joel as a guy, one, who could just shoot corner threes at 40%, but two, just take the best opposing wing in a playoff series like Tatum or, you know, whoever else. They just missed a huge opportunity with that.
Realistically, what would it have cost, man? DeAnthony Melton plus some stuff? Like,
dude, it would have been Tobias Harris on like 3 first-round picks. That's what it would have been. And they just didn't.
And then
do
they
it.
Instantly make a massive impact. It's a sign for teams in the future, man. You look at what OG Anunoby brings to this team. It is a sign to you in the future that like any time a player like that is available and you can get him for cheap, do it now.
Yep. Yep. It's team building is the hardest thing in sports, right? It's from our couches, we can all like criticize these guys and, you know, say, hey, these people suck. Right. And honestly, they do, right? They do suck. But like, if we were in the positions, like, would we have wanted to shell out a 4th first-round pick for OG Anunoby? I don't know.
Right?
Like, I don't know. But it just seems like they've missed every possible chance to optimize his fucking prime. And it does drive me a little crazy.
Yeah, I am right with you on that. I think that's it, man. I think that's all the second round series. Before we wrap this up, JP, do you got anything else?
I got nothing.
All right, that'll do it. Thanks everybody for tuning in. We'll catch you later. Peace.
Peace.